The Bible reading for this morning will be in Revelation chapter 21. Revelation 21, verse 9. And there came unto me one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials full of the last plagues, and talked with me, saying, Come hither, I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife.
One thing I failed to mention, and it's mainly for the visitors, we will have a meal after worship service when Brother Webster gets through feeding us spiritually. We'll get fed physically, and Brother Scotty Sanford will have closing prayer, and he'll bless that meal so that we can go straight over there. Everything will be ready. So, Brother Wade Webster is married to Jennifer and has four children, Parker, Claire, Emma, and Sophie. He attended Memphis School of Preaching and the Jacksonville State University with BA and an MA in English. He's worked a couple of years as an adjunct professor for the Jacksonville State University and Faulkner University in Alabama. He has preached in churches in Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas. He is presently preaching at the Bridgewater Congregation in Katy, Texas. He has also done mission work in Central America and Mexico, and also teaching at Southwest School of Biblical Studies and Brown Trail School of Preaching. Come preach to us.
A bride for God's Son. Bride for God's Son. I want to start with a story. I was preaching in Crossville, Tennessee. We had a lady in the congregation named Jean Fields. She was a fine Christian lady. And she was known for baking marriage cakes. And she would decorate those cakes, and they had all types of intricate designs and layers and big and small flowers. And people came from all around to get her to do their wedding cakes. And I remember how everybody was so proud of her and the work that she did. The interesting thing was she helped a lot of people walk down the aisle and celebrate that wonderful day, but she never walked down the aisle. She never got to experience that herself. That was her way of being a part of other people's joy and other people's celebration. She eventually died, and I was asked to preach her funeral. And so I got up at her funeral, and I started preaching the funeral, and I started talking about her life, and I talked about how that she had been married and how that they had been married for over 70 years, and I talked about what a wonderful husband she had and what a great relationship they had with each other. And I remember seeing a lot of strange looks in the audience, and people were thinking, he's confused, he's mixed up, he's got the wrong person in mind as he's preaching this funeral. And then when I was afraid somebody was about to come up and whisper in my ear, you got all the details wrong, I said, I understand what you're thinking. I understand what the natural approach would be to this. But I want you to now know that she's been a Christian for over 70 years. And when she obeyed the gospel, she married Christ according to Romans chapter 7. And she had a relationship with Jesus according to Ephesians chapter 5 as the head of the church, and as the church being his bride and being in submission to him. And they had a wonderful relationship. They could not have had a better relationship than they did. She was faithful to him in life. She was faithful to him in everything that she did. And it was just a beautiful thing to see the relationship that she had with the Lord. She had a perfect husband, and she did her best to please and submit to that husband. Those of us who are Christians here today, we're in that situation. Whether we're married physically or not, we are married spiritually. And we do have that relationship, and that relationship is the most important relationship we will ever have with any person. Because that is a relationship that's going to continue beyond this life. Our physical relationship is not going to continue beyond this life. I'm not saying we're not going to know each other in heaven. I'm not saying that we're not going to somehow enjoy heaven together. But we're not going to be as we are now. We're going to be like the angels. We're not going to be given in marriage. We're not going to have the same experience there that we have here. That is designed for our good here. that is designed to help us to get from here to there. And once we get there, we're not going to need that same relationship anymore. It's going to have accomplished its purpose. But as we think about the church and we think about all the images that the Bible gives us of the church, we think about the church as a body. We think about the church as an army. We think about the church as a flock. We think about all these images of the church, a vineyard. We think about these images, and they're all beautiful images, and they all give us some aspect of our relationship to the Lord. Of course, the body is all about function. The army is all about fighting. The vineyard is all about bearing fruit. And the flock is all about following. They each show us some aspect of our relationship to Jesus. But maybe the most beautiful of all of them is the image of the bride. And the image of the bride, of course, shows us faithfulness. It shows us this relationship where two individuals have left all others, forsaken all others, and they've committed themselves to each other, and they're doing their best to build a relationship where two become one. They're building a relationship where they're going to get to the point to where they know what each other's thinking. They are so close to each other that they almost can read each other's minds. They built such an intimate, wonderful relationship over the years. And so we want to talk about that relationship this morning. Now, as we do that, we're going to do it through this background. We're going to look at the Jewish wedding customs, the customs that those that heard Jesus speak in the New Testament and those that heard the apostles preach and teach in the New Testament, these things would have been easily understood by them, but they're likely missed by us. There's a lot of times in the Bible where the Bible uses language that they would have readily associated with wedding and marriage, and we don't associate it that way at all. And because we don't see that in it, we miss something beautiful about it. So hopefully this morning we'll change that. As we think about the wedding customs, the first wedding custom is really comes out in the passage that we're talking about, Revelation 21 and verse 9, where John says that one of the seven angels said to him, "Come here, let me show you the bride, the Lamb's wife." Can you imagine what John saw? Can you imagine what John saw in this vision that was shown to him when he got to see the church in all of her glory and all of her beauty? We don't often get to see that. We sometimes get to see the human side of the church. We sometimes get to see the imperfect side of the church. But John got to see the church in its perfection. What a beautiful picture that must have been for him. But one of the differences between their wedding customs and our wedding customs was this. After we have a marriage ceremony, usually there's a reception that follows. And we go back into a separate room, and there the bride and the groom will be. And everyone will come up and they begin to tell the bride how beautiful she was, how beautiful her dress was, how beautiful her hair looked, how well her makeup was done. They go through all these things about how beautiful she was and what a beautiful wedding, what a beautiful ceremony it was. The groom has little to nothing to do with that. He's just kind of sitting there as people come by and talk about how beautiful she was. That's okay, but that's usually what happens. Their wedding customs were very different. You see, when there was a marriage that took place, there was a reception that followed. But instead of coming up to the bride and telling her how beautiful she was, they would come up to the groom. And they would tell the groom, what a wise choice he made in his bride. They would tell him how beautiful his bride was. You see, she had adorned herself for him. She had made herself beautiful for him. And so it was about him, not about her. It was about him making a good choice, him making the right decision, about him having someone who would bless his life and give him all that he wanted in life. It was about him. So let's talk about these wedding customs. First wedding custom involves the arrangement. You know that the weddings of the Bible were arranged marriages. Well, the concept's kind of foreign to us. I'll be honest with you. I didn't want it. When I was growing up, I didn't want my mom and dad picking who I was going to marry. I wanted to get that choice. I didn't want their, and I maybe didn't even want their input in that, right? I thought, you made your choice, let me make my choice. It was kind of the attitude that I have. I certainly don't want to do that for my children because I don't want to be responsible for it. I just don't want to be responsible. If 5 years down the line they hate each other and they're not getting along with each other, I don't want them pointing at me and saying, "You set us up. You did this. It's your fault." They may say that anyway, but it's not going to be because I arranged it. Because if I had my choice, I wouldn't arrange any of them. I just, maybe my son, but girls, I'm not getting rid of my girls. I'd keep my girls. Now, my son, he needs some help, so I might arrange something for him. But for them, I'm not going to do that. But they don't get that choice. That's not our system. But it was the system in the Bible, and it was known by the term shadukin. Shadukin. That was the arrangement. And the fathers made the arrangements. The fathers would say, "I think my son would be good for your daughter. I think my daughter would be good for your son." And so they begin to plot and plan and decide at what age they're going to take this next step. But they're arranging things. They're making plans. You remember that in the Old Testament, Genesis chapter 24, that Abraham was older and Abraham was concerned about Isaac. Concerned about Isaac finding a bride, and he didn't want Isaac to find a bride from among the people of the land. And so he had a trusted servant, Eliezer, and he said, "Eliezer, I want you to go back to where I'm from, and I want you to go back there, and I want you to find a bride for my son." It's a tremendous responsibility. And Eliezer felt the weight of that responsibility. And so Eliezer says, "Well, what if I find somebody and she won't come?" And Abraham said, "You don't worry about that. God will take care of that. You just go do what I told you to do." And so he goes. And Eliezer comes up with a plan. He prays to God. He's trusting in God. He says, "God, I'm going to sit by this well of water. And when someone comes up here, I'm going to ask them to give me a drink. And if they offer to give me a drink, but they also offer to give a drink to each of my camels, then I'll know she's the one." And so he's sitting on that well. And this young woman walks up. This is Rebecca. Rebecca walks up and he asks for a drink of water. She offers him a drink of water. And then she says, "And I'll draw for your camels as well." That's a lot of work. You know how much water camels can drink? Now, a man can drink a good bit of water if he's thirsty and been walking a while, but a camel, they just keep sucking that water down. And so for her to say, "I'll water all of your camels," that was quite an industrious young woman. And this servant knew, God's helping me. God's with me. He had jewelry. He began to give her jewelry. He went back to her family and began to make arrangements with her family and began to show them the riches that he brought with him and to ask for her to go with him. Now, she had a choice. According to Genesis 24, 57 through 58, they said to the young woman, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." And that's the story of Isaac and Rebekah. As she goes back and becomes Isaac's wife, she had a choice. Let me tell you, we had a choice to marry Christ. And if we made that choice, we made the best choice we could ever make. We made a decision to marry the best man there's ever been. And we made that choice willingly. Nobody forced us into making it. Oh, there were arrangements that were made even before the foundation of the world. You read Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 4, God chose us to be the elect of his son. He chose us to be the bride of his son. And we are accepted. Ephesians 1, 6 says we are accepted in the beloved. We're accepted in Jesus. God had this in mind all along. But we had a choice. We could say yes. We could say no. We could reject the offer. But thankfully, many of us have accepted that offer. And so we have become the wife of his son, Jesus. Now, the second part of the wedding custom was this. The second part of the wedding custom was the contract. It's called the ketubah, the contract. Now, the contract was generally a written contract. It was a contract that spelled out the requirements of the parties involved in the marriage and the responsibilities that they had to each other. It contained a lot of promises that were made to the bride from the groom, and they also contained the price that would be paid for her. And so it was an important contract that was made. Now, in this contract, we think about this ketubah, we think about these requirements. The requirements, of course, for the groom was he was going to provide for her, he was going to protect her, he was going to be the head of the family, He was going to do all these things for her. Now, for her, her requirements were to be in submission. Ephesians 5, 22 and 23 will show the submission, the honor that she's going to give to him. We think about the promises. Oh, he made some wonderful promises in this ketubah to his wife in this contract. And the promises, you think about the ketubah for us is the New Testament. It is this law that Jesus has given to us. And in this ketubah, there are some exceedingly great and precious promises that have been made to us. 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 4. Oh, think about the promises that Jesus has promised us in the New Testament. When we're married to him, when we're his children, when we're his servants, when we're his bride. We think about the price that was paid. Never has a higher price been paid for any bride than was paid for us. Jesus purchased us with his own blood. Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, Ephesians 5, 25, he gave himself for us. He was willing to pay that high price for us. Now, the bride, she would treasure this ketubah. She would treasure this contract. She would read it over and over again because of how much it meant to her. She usually would display it in a prominent place in her home so that any guest or any person that came in the home could look over on the wall and see this wedding contract, these promises that had been made to her, this profession of love that her husband had given to her. Now, as we think about the application of that, I want to tell a story. You know the story of Johnny Lingo? Johnny Lingo was a trader, a well-known trader. He lived in the South Sea Islands, and he had a reputation for always getting the best deal. That is, until it came to getting a wife. In that part of the world, you purchased a wife, and you purchased a wife using livestock, using cattle. And so an average wife could be purchased for about 3 cows. An excellent wife could be purchased for about 5 cows. Johnny Lingo fell in love with a young woman named Sarita. And by all estimates, she was average. She should have been purchased for about 3 cows. She was kind of shy and a little bit awkward. She didn't have the grace and the beauty that would require a greater payment. But when Johnny Lingo arranged the deal for his wife, for Sarita, he paid the unheard-of price of 8 cows. 8 cows. And there were those that believed finally somebody had gotten the better deal with Johnny. Somehow somebody had tricked Johnny into paying more than he should have had to pay. And so there was someone asking him one day and said, why did you pay so much for Sarita? He said, well, let me explain something. He said, when the women go to the marketplace, they talk. And one of the things they talk about is how much their husband paid for them. And can you imagine my Sarita being in the marketplace and her having to reveal that she was purchased at a very low price? Can you imagine what that would do to her? How that would make her feel? How awkward that would be for her to say, well, I was purchased for this many cows. He said, I never wanted her to feel that. I wanted her to be able to say, I was purchased for this extremely high price, for it to be a price above anybody else in the marketplace, because I wanted her to know how much I loved her, and I wanted everybody else to know that as well. I wanted her to feel how much she was loved. I want to suggest to you that Jesus wants us to feel how much we're loved. When Jesus was willing to die on the cross for us, that was Jesus saying, I'll pay the highest price out there for you to become my bride, for you to become one of mine. I'm willing to pay that price. And that allows us to walk with grace. It allows us to hold our heads up in honor. It allows us to rejoice in one who loved us that much. That's this contract that we're talking about. And I want to suggest to you that we ought to be reading this over and over and over again. Simply because of the precious promises that are found in it, we should be reading it all over again because of all the things that Jesus has promised to do for us. We need to be reading it over and over again because it's spelling out the responsibilities and the requirements that we have to him. We need to be reading this over and over again. And we need to be displaying it in our homes. I don't mean that we physically place a copy of the New Testament or even verses from the New Testament on our wall. There's nothing wrong with that. But I want to suggest that in our homes, that we're showing to those that enter our homes the marriage that we have with Christ. That when they leave our home, they say, that person has a relationship with Jesus Christ. That person has a love for Jesus Christ. That person tries to honor Jesus Christ in everything they say and they do. Then when we think about the third part of the wedding custom of the Jews, it was the betrothal ceremony. It's called Urusin. Now what this was a time when the bride and the groom came together and they professed their love to each other. They exchanged vows with each other. They even exchanged rings on this occasion. So it was a very important part of this process. And it was the case that once they had done this, they were legally married. Now they were going to be living at separate places. They had not yet come together as husband and wife, but they were legally married at this point. They would go through a couple of things. One was these vows and these promises, they were made underneath the huppah. The huppah was a bridal canopy, and it meant to symbolize their future home. And so underneath this canopy, they would profess their love and say these vows and exchange these rings. Now, a part of this was also the mikvah, which was the immersion in water. Each of them would be immersed in water in preparation for their life together. This would be a purification. This would be a cleansing, preparing them going into marriage. I think there's something beautiful about that. I think what's beautiful about that is that this immersion, this preparation for marriage, cleansing yourself to come together with this other person. We think about our need to do that. We had a need to do that because we have sins and we needed our sins to be washed away, Acts 22 and verse 16. Now, Jesus had no sin, so he had no need to have his sins washed away. We know that he explains in Matthew chapter 3 to John, who John's reluctant to baptize Jesus. He says to Jesus, I need to be baptized of you, and you're coming to me. And Jesus said, suffer it to be so now, for thus it becometh us to fulfill all righteousness. Jesus said, John, we need to do this to fulfill all righteousness. Now, the background of that is, all of God's commandments are righteousness, Psalm 119, 172. And God had commanded baptism through John. And so though Jesus did not need to be baptized for the remission of his sins, he did need to be baptized to obey God. God had commanded it. He had to keep the commandments of God. He had to suffer it. He had to allow it for the purpose of being righteous. And he did that. But I want you to think about something greater than that. When Jesus was baptized, you ever thought about the fact that Jesus was preparing himself to take his bride? He was preparing him for the day when the church was going to be established on the earth, and she was going to become his bride, and he's making himself ready for that. There's something beautiful in that. We understand our side and our need, something beautiful in his choice and his willingness to do that. Another thing that they did on this occasion, in this betrothal ceremony, is they shared a glass of wine. They shared grape juice together. They each would have a drink of it, and then they would not drink this again until they came back together at the end of this betrothal period. So that leads us to the next point. Now, that betrothal period, as I mentioned, the wine that would be drunk at that time, that parallels something in the New Testament, doesn't it? You remember that Jesus drank this fruit of the vine with his disciples, and he said, I will not drink it anew with you until I drink it with you in my Father's kingdom, Matthew 26, 28, and 29. But let's go to the next phase of this, and that is the betrothal period. The betrothal period, that's the Mekadesh. Now, the betrothal period was about a year. It wasn't the exact time, but it was about a year that after they said these vows, exchanged these rings, that they would live apart, and then they would come back together, and then from that point on, they would be together forever. Now, this betrothal period was a time when each of them would go back to their father's house. And as they went back to their father's house, they would have responsibilities at their house, their father's house, to get ready for the wedding, to get ready for the coming back together again. And so what's going to happen is the groom is going to go back to his father's house, and he's going to make a room ready for his wife. He's going to add a room on to his father's house, and when they come back together, he's going to bring his bride to his father's house, and there they're going to live together. They're going to be husband and wife there together. That's where the consummation is going to take place, and that's where they're going to begin their days of living together forever. That's what he was doing. You remember what Jesus said in John chapter 14, verses 1 through 3? Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Now, we never thought about that as wedding language. That's exactly what it is. Jesus was telling the disciples, I'm going to the Father's house. I'm going to put a room there, and I'm coming back at some future time to take you to that room. Now, he did not know exactly when that time would be. Again, we said it was about a year. If you had asked the groom at his father's house, when are you going to go back and get your bride? You know what he would have said? Only my father knows. Only my father knows. He might have said, when my father says so. You remember what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 13, talking about his second coming? He said, but of that day and hour knoweth no man, not the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but my Father only. Father's the only one that knows. And so one day God's going to say to Jesus, Jesus, it's son, it's time for you to go get your bride. What a glorious, wonderful day that's going to be. And Jesus comes to take his bride. Now, when that happened, what would happen is the friends of the bridegroom would go in front of the bridegroom, and they would start making the announcement. They would blow the shofar, they would blow the horn, the ram's horn, and they would begin announcing, behold, the bridegroom is coming. Behold, the bridegroom is coming. And everyone would come out, and they would line the streets to be a part of the joyous celebration of him going to get his bride and of their making their way back to the Father's house. That's what we read about in 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 and 17, where we find the Lord's going to descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God. That's going to happen. And then when he gets his bride, the Bible says, and so shall they ever be with the Lord. They're going to live together forever. You read about that in Matthew chapter 25. You read about in Matthew chapter 25 in verse 6, where those go before the bridegroom and they begin to announce, behold, the bridegroom is coming. What a beautiful picture that is. But then the bride, what was she doing during this period? What was she doing during this period of betrothal? She's made the promises, taken the vows, exchanged the rings, but they're not together yet. He's at his father's house. She's at her father's house. And so what is she doing in this time? Well, one of the things that she's doing in this time is she's making her wedding dress. Wedding dresses are elaborate dresses. They're not dresses that are made easily or quickly. They take a lot of time. And so she's no doubt making intimate and stitches in making this gown, maybe sewing pearls and sewing other things into this gown, making it as beautiful as she possibly can. And that's going to take a lot of time. Making sure it fits just so, making sure everything is just right. When he catches a glimpse of her, it's going to take his breath away. That's what she's trying to do. She's trying to adorn herself for her husband. Now, I'll tell you, my wife is beautiful in sweats and an old t-shirt. And she's beautiful without any makeup. Now, she would deny that. But it doesn't change anything. She is. But when she decides, I'm going to get dressed up, when she decides I'm going to fix myself up, it's another level, right? You know what I'm talking about. And when a woman gets ready for her wedding day, that's another level where she's put hours of preparation in. She's put a lot of thought and attention to every single detail, from her hair to her jewelry to everything about that day. She's designed it in a certain way. And so that's one of the things that she's doing. But the main thing that she's doing during this period is she's keeping herself pure. This is a year where they're separated. Is she going to remain pure? Is she going to forsake all others? Is she going to save herself for her groom that is coming. That's the real test. Now, they're legally married at this point, but they're not together yet. Go back to Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 and 19. Think about Joseph and Mary. They were betrothed to each other. They'd made the promises. They exchanged the rings. They'd done all of that. And so they're waiting for the day when they're going to get married. And during this period, what happens? Mary is with child. What does Joseph think? Joseph thinks she's been unfaithful. She's been with somebody else. During this period when I was away, getting things ready for her to come and to live with me at my father's house, she's been doing something else. She's been unfaithful. And so he was minded to put her away. Now, in order to put her away, it would have required a writing of divorcement. It was not an easy process to do that. It would have involved other people being a part of the process, and it would have been embarrassing to Joseph and to Mary. And Joseph was willing to suffer the shame in order to protect Mary. But that's what's going on in that situation. That's the background of that situation. Then the final part of the wedding ceremony, of the wedding traditions of the Jews, was this marriage supper. This marriage supper. It's called the Simcha. It lasted for about 7 days. It was a day of feasting. It was a day of joy. It was a day when they came together. He came to get his bride, brought her back to the father's house, and now the marriage is consummated, and now they're going to have this wonderful celebration with their friends and with their family. There's going to be all kinds of food. There's going to be all kinds of drink. There's going to be the sharing of the wine again. They had the wine, the betrothal ceremony, and now they're going to have this wine. And you remember John chapter 2, the picture of this wedding feast at Cana? And Jesus turning the water to wine, not alcoholic wine, but grape juice, and how that they shared in the joy of that event. Now, when we think about Revelation chapter 19, I want you to look at Revelation chapter 19 and verse 9. It says, "Then he said to me, write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are the true sayings of God. Blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb." We've been called. We get to go to the marriage supper of the Lamb. We sometimes sing the song, "Come to the feast. All things are ready. Come to the feast." We get to come to the feast. And what a feast it's going to be. We're espoused to Jesus right now. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2. But on that day, we're going to get to be with Jesus and enjoy the marriage supper with the Lamb. That part hasn't come yet. That's what we're headed toward. We're in the period where we're to be keeping ourselves faithful, waiting and looking for that day, keeping our lamps trimmed, waiting for the coming of the bridegroom, waiting for someone to make the cry, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming." That's where we are right now. We get to enjoy that feast. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that. In fact, I know we've never seen anything like that. In 2 Kings chapter 4, you read about Solomon. The Bible says that Solomon fed 10,000 at his table every day. Solomon stood out among all the people of the world for his wisdom, for his wealth. And imagine 10,000 people eating at his table every day. And he goes through all the things that had to be prepared, of all kinds of cattle, of all kinds of birds, of all kinds of animals, of all kinds of things that were prepared every day to feed the crowd that was there. But what does Luke chapter 11 tells us about Jesus? "Oh, Solomon in all of his glory, but a greater than Solomon is here." We have a greater than Solomon, and his marriage feast, his table is going to be a greater table served with greater foods. I cannot imagine what that day would be. Will be like. What a beautiful picture it is when we think about a bride for God's Son. We think about the New Testament church and the fact that we get to be a part of it. We get to be a part of this wonderful relationship with our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, awaiting His coming when we can go and live with Him in the place that He's prepared for us and be with Him forever. This morning, it may be the case that you've not yet married Christ. You've not yet made that choice. He's made the offer, but you've got to accept that offer. That offer involves believing, repenting, confessing, and being baptized. Yes, being baptized, that's an immersion in water. It needs to be done for you in order for you to have the remission of sins, but it also needs to be done in preparation for marriage, because you're marrying Christ, and you've got to be pure and ready to become his bride, become his wife. And then your responsibility as the child of God, as the bride of Christ, will be for you to keep yourself pure, unspotted from the world. James 1 and verse 27, to be faithful even to the day of your death. Revelation 2 and verse 10. So it may be the case you've never obeyed the gospel, you haven't married Christ. Or it may be the case that you have accepted that offer that he's given to you, but you have not kept yourself pure during this period, this espousal period. And so you're awaiting his coming, but you're not ready for his coming because there's impurities in your life. You've not been faithful to him. That needs to be corrected before he comes, so that when he comes, you can go with him and live with him forever. We invite you to come if you need to this morning as we stand and as we sing.